Majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora, Davide. How are we going?
I'm Eli, I bet. I'm Seda.
Hi.
So we've got some very exciting news.
Yeah, there is more in the world of science, and today I have like three stories for you all. The first one is about bald people. Bald as people without hair, that lose their hair.
Yeah.
And apparently there is hope for people that lose their hair, because there is a piece of science that has been coming out of Northwestern University very recently, and they have basically linked baldness to the stiffness of the cells that actually hair follicles, let's say. And as people get stiff when they get old, hair follicle stem cells also get stiff with age. So they started thinking that the secret to baldness or not getting bald was about cell mechanics. And what they did, they tried to think along the line of reverting the course of, let's say, these cells by making them more elastic, by playing a little bit with their mechanics. And of course, this is like a complicated issue. The hope of every scientist is to find like a single molecule on which you can act on and reverse the course of an entire cellular line, let's say. And they apparently found it. They have identified a single molecule that is majorly involved in regulating cell mechanics of hair follicles, let's say stem cells. And this molecule is not a protein, but is a microRNA.
Wow.
So these microRNAs are actually very interesting. They are very, very small strands of single-stranded ribonucleic acid, mm-hmm. which are different from the DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. Mm-hmm. And they act as regulatory molecules inside the cell. And they are tiny pieces that have an enormous impact on the cell. And they are useful for many different things, like making proteins, control a process called translation, which is basically the process of translating DNA, RNA into proteins, or like they help in splitting cells, or they help with cell division, proliferation. And they help also with all sorts of genetic regulations. Now, within the multiple copies of these RNAs, these different microRNAs, they have identified this microRNA 205.
Yeah.
Now, if you are bold in this moment, you want to remember this microRNA 205, because that's the key to actually get your cells in line and regrow air, because they have discovered that this microRNA 205 controls cytoskeleton rearrangement. The cytoskeleton is a little bit like the scaffolding within the cells that controls the mechanics of the cells.
Right.
And what they have done, they have genetically modified mice in order to make overexpress this microRNA 205. Now, and that's when they found something astonishing. When they overexpress this microRNA 205, the stem cells, the hair follicle stem cells, start to regrow hair in as fast as 10 days.
Wow.
So these mice actually started getting hair back in 10 days without any complications, or actually known complications. So it does seem to be a problem of cell mechanics, and there is a single molecule that we can target in order to restore the elasticity in these cells so that they can regrow hair. Now, the problem is they have engineered mice. And of course, I mean, the jump between mice and men is a large one. You cannot genetically engineer people.
No,
well, you can, harder. You shouldn't.
You shouldn't.
You definitely shouldn't. So how do you teach all the human cells new tricks like regrowing hair? They are exploring other ways, like, for example, linking these microRNA 205 to nanoparticles that can actually be delivered directly in situ, and they can prompt the regrowth of human hair.
Wow.
So there is hope for bald people, let's say. Not that I'm getting bald, but you never know.
There is hope. I call it follically challenged.
Yeah.
But so would it happen as quickly in humans? I mean, 10 days is... astonishing.
It is astonishing. Nobody knows at the moment, to be honest.
No.
It's just like sit and wait. To be honest, I think that anybody that is losing their hair wouldn't mind in having their hair back in 10 or 20, or even if I have to wait several months. I think it's worth. At the moment, I think they transplant the hair.
Yeah.
And this is a long and painful process, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Never been through one, but...
Sure is. Yeah. No, I think... that would be great if there was a painless way to get your hair back.
There you go.
Yeah.
Apparently there could be. We will wait and see.
Exciting.
And of course, I mean, this microRNA could also fulfill different functions in humans, so you never know.
Totally. It's an interesting line of research, that microRNA. So you've also got one about fake science. Is it too good to be true?
Yeah, fake science is a real and a growing problem, actually. And I was astonished by this study that has just come out. And it was carried out by a biomedical team, biomedical team of research. And they wanted to identify, basically it was prompted by somebody that approached them, asking them to publish a paper, an article, and was too good to be true, as you say. And they wanted to understand how much fake publications are out there and how to spot fake publications, let's say fake science. Also because the trust in integrity of the academic publishing is all based, is all at the basis of scientific advance, let's say, right? So if you can't trust what's out there, you cannot really build science upon science and stuff like this, and you cannot even allocate public money to it. So the system of outputting scientific knowledge is literally under threat by the so-called paper mills. Have you ever heard of them?
I have heard of them, yeah.
Right. So these paper mills are actual companies that advertise writing and editing services for a price. They are very expensive. For each piece of science that you would like to publish, you have a price that goes in the thousands, with hundreds of dollars per picture. They even charge per picture.
Wow.
And they have no problems in promoting, let's say, shady practices like publishing manipulated data or publishing data that has been collected without any substantial statistical robustness, so therefore is not reproducible, let's say, which is one of the fundamental thing that science should be.
Yeah.
Now, the first question would be why scientists fall into the trap of paper mills, right? And the answer to this question is not easy. But there are some parameters that favor this behavior. Let's say academic and also institutional policies sometimes are devoted towards simply counting the number of papers that you publish as a scientist. And this is a proxy for scientific excellence. So no matter what you publish, it's just how much you publish. And that's a problem. So there is a pressure on scientists to meet certain publication quota. And there is, publication numbers without publication quality is real, a problem. So institutions should look into that. But anyway, to cut the long story short, the problem is very complex, but authors of this article aim to estimate the extent of fake publishing, right, by reaching out directly to authors. And they prepared a questionnaire asking them several things, running proper controls by doing the same thing with authors of publications that were clearly not fake. And the questionnaire were designed to build indicators that could spot fake science. And what they found was actually quite alarming, really sinister, I would say. So they analyzed more than 15,000 papers published in the last 10 years, let's say. And they basically found that authors that are contributing to fake publications, they fail to provide critical information about their research. They mostly tend to use their private email address rather than their institutional email addresses.
Wow.
And they avoid answering when you ask the actual raw data, because that's that's when it's going to spot if you are
so
fake
made
or not.
Up.
Now, I'm not sure you want to know how much it is in terms of like how much is the problem quantified at, but let's say one out of three publications in the neuroscience field is probably fake. So 33.7%.
Oh my gosh.
And medicine is 24%, just because you cannot really easily fake clinical trials,
no,
let's say.
You can't. Yeah.
And they also extrapolated this by country. Basically, there are countries that contribute a little bit more.
Where's the most fake science?
The most fake science is in Russia and China, followed suit by Turkey and Egypt. So these and India. These must be. These are the five countries that are prominently, promoting these kind of practices. Now, this said, it's interesting to see that, for example, countries that are culturally similar, like Ukraine and Russia, they don't have the same statistics. So Russia is 40% plus, while Ukraine only 3%. And this may be telling us that it's about government and the policies that this government made to avoid these practices.
Yeah, you'd hope that all governments put policy in place because, in the field of medicine, it's life and death.
Yes.
If it's fake research.
Yes, and it's billions and billions of dollars. So they have estimated that we are around $1 to $4 billion in fake science per year. So imagine this money repurposed, refunneled towards proper
science.
Right.
That would be good to see.
Yeah, so I'm sure there will be more to come in the future about this.
And from billions of dollars to billions of years. What's this one about?
Billions of years. So the boring billion. Have you ever heard about the boring billion?
No. Yes.
It's
bit of a dry patch.
Yeah.
Evolutionary-wise.
Pretty much. Right. So the boring billion refers to a billion of years in which the Earth's rotation might have being in a way where the day length has stopped, has not basically increased steadily over time. A common theory in the Earth's what they call paleo rotation is that in the Earth rotation was basically faster with the daytime being shorter if you go back in time. Has not always been 24 hours a day. It's not always been 24 hours long, let's say a day-night cycle. And this is because the moon back then was closer and had a stronger gravitational pull on our planet. And then, of course, things have changed over billions of years. And most models do predict that the day length was proportionally shorter. As you go back, it's proportionally shorter. However, these records were basically extracted from sedimentary rocks that hold the memory of the mud, the layering, basically the moon controls the tides, for example, and that's what they looked at. These tidal records are rare, and these preserved records are also disputed many times. So this group of scientists has actually used a different technique, which is called cyclostratigraphy, which relies on something called the Milankovitch records. So these are like variations in sedimentary rocks, right? And so they are much more common to find. And they observed that for a good billion years, the length of the day would have stopped at 19 hours. 19 hours a day. A billion years in which nothing happens, pretty much. and that's why they call it the boring billion. Now, this is good news in being boring.
It is.
And being boring for a billion years is apparently allowed. This is theory, of course. This is a theory, but it's pretty much backed up. It's apparently allowed photosynthetic bacteria to evolve properly. Having this like steady period of boring 19 hours. and that's when, after the boring billion, you see another increase in the oxygen levels, which were on the planet, because this evolutionary track of photosynthetic bacteria has been allowed thanks to the boring billion.
That is incredible. So there's no harm in being boring.
Not too much. I wouldn't go as far as saying there is no harm at all, but yeah, you shouldn't be. But if you are, maybe there's
a purpose. Maybe you're making photosynthetic bacteria.
Exactly.
Oh, well, that was wonderful. Thank you, Davide, and thank you, science. And
thank you,
MoTeP. Yeah.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MoTeP, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Around up to